Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email and phone. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, I thought I would start out just sharing with you some thoughts that were generated in the last few weeks around flibanserin, which is the drug that received final FDA approval because it had a potential to improve sexual satisfaction in women. Apparently, there is a ICDM code for this, hypoactive sexual desire disorder, and a medication that has been controversial, I might add. Flibanserin has been trying to get authorized for, over 5 years, and was initially turned down because it was not terribly effective, but bought up by another company and more studies and resubmit it. Lots of money, by the way, in this process. And the question is, does this actually work? How does it work? And does it have the potential to be another so-called blockbuster pharmaceutical? Now, in thinking about this, I found myself thinking about graphic equalizers, which many of the younger audience may not know what those are, but audiophiles or people who had fancy stereo systems will remember. And basically, the frequency spectrum of sound is broken up in various ways. You can have treble, bass, and mid-range. That's the simplest one. And you can dial up the treble or dial up the bass. And certainly we've all had the experience of walking down the street and having someone drive by with the bass cranked and you practically feel like your teeth vibrate. Well, this is actually a pretty reasonable analogy for both how neurotransmitters work and how this drug works in particular. Now, 5-HT, that's serotonin, it's basically a neurotransmitter. There's dopamine, norepinephrine, GABA, there's glutamate, there's dozens of neurotransmitters. In fact, you know, things that we don't really think about, like cyclic AMP is a neurotransmitter. And all of these things are dancing, a really complicated dance. And effectively, at different sites, these neurotransmitters behave differently. They also feed back on themselves and on each other. For example, in some parts of the brain, dopamine lowers the response to the hormone prolactin. In other parts of the brain, it increases it. And of course, you have the action of hormones that are produced at a distance, such as testosterone or estrogen, and how they influence the brain, because these two are direct neurotransmitters. In fact, the distinction between neurotransmitters and hormones is a little, let's just say it is not actually real. It's a intellectual convenience for us when we try to think about these complex systems. But really, there's so much overlap. Well, flibanserin acts on 5-HTP, and it is an antagonist at one receptor, the 5-HT2A receptor, and an agonist, that is a stimulant, at the 5-HT1A receptor, and a partial agonist at the dopamine receptor. So what you've got here is something that really is ambiguous in terms of how it's going to be received at any given point in the brain. In some places, turning up the bass, in some places, turning it down. But ultimately, in at least a percentage of women, it shakes out to improve sexual desire such that successful sex is possible. Now, since in couples, mismatch between male sexuality and drive and female sexuality drive is very, very common. You know, this could be the answer to that "can this marriage be saved" questions for some relationships. The problem is it's not as simple as changing erections. That's what Viagra does, and it does it by increasing the amount of time that there's nitric oxide present in the blood vessels. That keeps the blood vessels open. That's why it works on erections. Brains are a lot more complicated than that. And the main reason I'm talking about this is not because I think it's going to be a blockbuster or such a successful thing, but because it opens up an opportunity to emphasize to my audience the complexity of neurotransmitters and the extremely primitive, almost Jackson Pollock-like approach that we have. And that's not a bad, that's really not a bad example. Jackson Pollock was an artist who dripped little bits of paint onto canvas. He did it in a very mindful way, and some people really like that art. Other people look at it and see a chaotic pattern of drips. In the case of what we're doing with our psychology and our psychopharmacology, we're really contrasting Leonardo da Vinci with Jackson Pollock in terms of finesse and nuance. And so all I can say is the big pharma industry is going to keep doing what it does best, and it will provide an interesting backdrop for discussions of science. I'm going to go to a couple of emails right out of the box. Our first email goes out to Janet in New York, Schenectady, actually, New York State. "I'm a healthy 50-year-old woman and have recently faced my first battle with a kidney stone. I'd very much like to avoid getting another. I read a few papers I found on Google Scholar, but I couldn't find anything that seemed to apply to my behavior or eating habits. I'm a vegetarian, don't drink juice, and mostly drink tea, black and herbal. I found it particularly interesting that the studies contradicted the common ideas that the kidney stones are caused by calcium consumption. Your thoughts?" Yeah, you'll find that meme, it's awfully hard to get memes out once they're embedded in a culture, that kidney stones are caused by calcium consumption, and it's much more subtle than that. The amount of calcium is highly regulated by the kidney, the parathyroid glands, and the bones. The bones are a massive, massive calcium sink. And there are different kinds of kidney stones too, Janet. So hopefully yours was collected. There are uric acid stones, calcium oxalate stones, and other types of stones as well that are much, much rarer. But the point is, like citric acid stones, the point is that hydration is probably the key. And if you keep well hydrated, the chances of forming kidney stones are very, very small. Another really interesting research article that I saw that unfortunately I was not able to find the reference for this morning for your email was looking at the possibility that the probiotics, and particularly in women, this would refer to the probiotics in their vagina, might actually have a substantial influence on whether or not they formed stones. And I wish I could bring you that, but there was dysbiosis and stone formation. There was a strong association in at least one study. Our next email is from Annie in Arizona. And Annie writes, "Kombucha as an aid to liver support and detoxification. First of all, I love your show and have been a longtime listener. I want to know what you think the evidence-based health effects are from kombucha. I have been making mine at home and drink a pint a day. There are many claims that it aids in liver detoxification as well as many other benefits. I can only find one study to back this up. My liver enzymes have been elevated mildly for unknown reasons since last November, and I've slowly been coming down. I drink no alcohol, take no non-steroidals or Tylenol. I started drinking kombucha in April thinking it might help. Still a slow trend back to normal, but still elevated. I think I need to see a liver specialist. Just wanted your thoughts on this fermented drink and its effect on the liver." And Annie thoughtfully attached a very nice article on this, which I will post at AskDrDawn.com, or I'll post a link to it because it is available without your having to spend the $38 to read it. And there are a great number of studies looking at kombucha. So let's talk about liver detoxification for a moment. This article is goes over it in very nice detail, and I'll also point you to the archive where this where a discussion of detoxification is available in the interviews section. If you look for Jeffrey Bland, and I'll have that date for you in a few moments. But basically, when your body has to deal with all sorts of chemicals, that includes chemicals that you manufacture, like estrogen, and chemicals that come from the outside, like so-called xenohormones, and, of course, all of the new-to-nature molecules that we've been inventing since the 1940s and 1950s, when the age of plastic began. Bottom line here is that the liver has to do a lot of work, and the way it does it is by taking compounds. Most of the compounds we're talking about are fat-soluble, and the first thing the liver does is make them water-soluble, and it does that by attaching an oxygen and a hydrogen or a hydrogen group, and this creates a charge on the molecule, and then this molecule, because of the charge, won't pass just through cell walls without help. It needs it needs to be carried. That means you can store it in your gallbladder or store it in your bowel and or your bladder and get rid of it when the moment comes to excrete. In order to take that water-soluble reactive molecule and make it stay in the bile or in the bladder, you need to conjugate it. And that means attaching that reactive hydrogen and oxygen group to something else. Glutathione, which is one form of conjugation, sulfation and acetylation, and glucuronidation are other forms. And glucuronidate is derived from glucose chemically, and that's where kombucha comes in, because kombucha actually supplies a great deal of glucuronidate. So people who consume it on a regular basis are providing their body with a substrate that their body can then use to get rid of toxic compounds. That's a good thing. Eating, by the way, sulfur is sort of the second line go-to. And if there isn't enough glucuronidate around, then sulfur will pinch hit. This is probably why onions, leeks, and garlic are so important. And one of the reasons that the brassica or cruciferous vegetables are helpful as well. But the science is actually fairly advanced on kombucha. And there are a number of articles looking at mice and rats and other lab animals, and showing that kombucha reduces oxidative stress from various toxins, that it reduces free radicals, that it actually helps with cholesterol levels, at least in ducks. Don't know if it works for cholesterol in humans. I couldn't find any data on that. So, and there's a study looking at a drug, paracetamol, which is closely related to Tylenol and has similar liver toxicity profile. This drug is not available in the United States, but it is available in Europe, so we know a fair amount about overdose and toxicity. And essentially what it shows is that you benefit from the use of kombucha in situations where there's an overdose of paracetamol. So is it beneficial to the liver? Yes and no. It is not necessarily always going to increase detoxification. Actually, the reason it's protective on the liver is that it slows down conversion, the first level of detoxification, that putting the hydroxy groups on that makes the molecule reactive, can actually make molecules more dangerous and sometimes activate toxicity. So you could see kombucha as having a biphasic effect, rather like that agonist-antagonist flibanserin that I was talking about in the brain. So it isn't straightforward and it isn't simple, but I would say that the research in the main supports this as having a beneficial role. And one of the things I learned was that it does contain Saccharomyces species that might help prevent or reduce the chances of getting antibiotic-associated Clostridium difficile, just on the basis of what's growing in that sort of bacterial fungal mat on top of your kombucha. So I'm changing my attitude. I had this question a few years ago, and I was, at that point, there wasn't a lot of research that supported its use. That research has subsequently materialized in the last 3 years. So I'm now ready to give this a thumbs up and say that indeed it does appear to be beneficial. And it's kombucha. I'm sorry, not kombucha. I often mispronounce things. Sorry about that. The detoxification interviews were April 22nd, 2006, and you can find those by going to Ask Dr. Don and looking in the archives. Our next email is from Andrea in Long Beach, Washington. Cryptogenic organizing pneumonia. Hello, Dr. Don. This might be a new one for you. I've been on prednisone since July 14th, beginning at 50 milligrams after being bedridden for almost 3 months. Oh, my. She has been doing an elimination diet. She takes antioxidants, including curcumin, resveratrol, quercetin, ECGC, which is green tea extract, fish oil, and a good probiotic. I won't read the rest of the list, but fair to say that she's doing most, if not all, of the functional medicine things that I would have suggested for an inflammatory disease. And yet she continues to have this very aggressive organizing pneumonia. Now, cryptogenic organizing pneumonia is a situation where you have what looks like migratory infiltrates pneumonia in the brain, and you've got all sorts of things happening that are, well, clinically indistinguishable from a bacterial pneumonia, but nobody can culture any bacteria from the lung, and nobody is able to show a reason for this. So it doesn't appear to be viral, doesn't appear to be bacterial. It's definitely inflammatory, and we find in the lungs of people who have this condition an infiltrate that is primarily lymphocytic. So this falls into the classic idiopathic. The treatment essentially is suppress the immune system, and eventually this situation burns itself out and you're left with some scarring in the lung, but generally a reasonable amount of full recovery. Prednisone is, however, a very heavy-duty drug. And in this person's case, she's been unable to manage to taper it. Normally, people are able to taper it over about 6 months. In her case, she's now tried two tapers and keeps relapsing. So her immune system requires ongoing issues. Now, in terms of probiotics, Andrea, I think what you need to do is actually stop your probiotics for a couple of weeks and get stool testing, get DNA on your stool and see if there is a driver there, an inflammatory driver. I would also, if you haven't done so, go on a very low in antigenic diet. That would be like an elimination diet. You can find one of those on my website. And I think that would, if you haven't already done that, I think that would be important. And the concept here is that we're trying to identify and remove any inflammatory drivers, because something's keeping this process perpetuated. It's not burning itself out as it should. Low-dose naltrexone might be a solution here. You should definitely talk to your functional medicine doctor about that. It is an immune, it's a very interesting drug, actually. At higher doses, it inhibits opiates, and it's a blocker for the endorphins. It's also used as a pharmaceutical, Revia, for alcohol addiction, and it seems to reduce the urge to drink. It interferes with that reward pathway in the brain that makes people want that second, third, fourth, and fifth drink. And it is used in this country. It's taken daily in the morning. Actually, it's probably a bit more effective just for those people who are dealing with alcohol addiction, who want to hear more about this for a second. If you use the if you use this agent and you take it an hour or so before social drinking, it seems to work best in terms of reducing the urge for that second, third, and fourth drink. So a little hint, there's some backlash growing against the Alcohol Anonymous abstinence is the only way world, and this is one of the tools that the people who disagree with that are learning how to use. Another thing that I wanted to throw out, I realize I forgot to mention to Andrea in Washington, was low-dose naltrexone, but also inhaled glutathione. Glutathione is an antioxidant. We've talked about it earlier on this program in the context of the liver using glutathione to complex with toxins and get them out of the body. But and by the way, that's how you get rid of heavy metals like mercury and lead, is through glutathione conjugation. But inhaled glutathione is actually an established therapy for cystic fibrosis, which is an inflammatory condition of the lung caused by a mutation in the ability to make good mucus. If in cystic fibrosis, the lung mucus is too thick and gooey to be coughed up, and it actually ends up acting as culture medium for bacteria. So people with this disease become colonized. And anyway, inhaled glutathione, I found, is a good way to get glutathione into people's systems to improve detoxification. And it is something that can be compounded safely. I always prefer giving compounded things topically, orally, or through the lung rather than intravenously, because anytime you put something directly into the bloodstream, you are really relying on the sterility and the stability of the compound at an order of magnitude more critical a level than when you put something like that against an epithelial surface that has its own innate protections for preventing stuff you don't want to get in, like fungal spores, from crossing over. We had an off-air question. Do I know anything about the Ayurvedic drug Bacopa? It's supposed to be good for memory, and that was a question mark. Bacopa is indeed a plant, an herb that is used in Ayurvedic medicine, and its primary function is as an adrenal adaptogen. Adaptogens are agents that support the adrenal gland, essentially strengthen its ability to react to stressors and to reset itself into a neutral setting. When people have a lot of stressors, sometimes they get stuck on accelerate, and the adrenal gland is churning out lots of adrenaline and secondarily lots of cortisol. These hyperdrive adrenal situations can persist for years, but eventually the gland begins to exhaust itself, and you can develop effectively a sort of light version of Addison's disease. Addison's is a very serious autoimmune condition in which the adrenal gland is attacked by antibodies, and without cortisol entirely, people become quite ill. And in fact, people with Addison's disease develop some unusual physiological symptoms, unusual pigmentation of the skin, for example, because their pituitary is putting out large levels of ACTH, adrenal cortical stimulation hormone, trying to get the adrenal glands to respond. So whipping that exhausted horse. And of course, the horse can't produce, but so you end up with a positive feedback loop. Treatment of this is, of course, giving people cortisol, but that's in an Addison's disease. And most people with mild, environmentally induced, not autoimmune adrenal fatigue can get by with herbal support and maybe non-hormonal adrenal extracts. That's the majority. Some people do require cortisol at low levels, but I consider that to be a very small minority of people who get themselves into trouble. Herbs like Bacopa support the adrenal glands. There's another one that in Ayurvedic medicine is called ashwagandha. And the reason that these have the positive memory association is because when you have a lot of adrenaline circulating in your system, you have a disrupted circadian rhythm. This also happens when your cortisol levels become erratic. And when you have a disrupted circadian rhythm, you don't sleep well, and you don't get that memory consolidation that comes with sleep. And you're also kind of exaggerated. Those hormones get into the brain, and you're typically triple tracking, running an anxiety list as well as trying to concentrate on just the day-to-day memory of where did you put your keys, where did you park your car, as well as getting the stuff done that you need to get done. And effectively, that anxiety soundtrack running in the back of your head that won't turn off is part of that graphic equalizer thing I was talking about earlier, where it interferes with hearing other sounds, or in this metaphor at least, with the ability of the brain to make new memory and retrieve existing memory. Looks like we have time for a science lesson, and I had a couple of weeks ago the opportunity to go to the Functional Medicine Conference, and there was a great many very, very useful bits of information there, and I've been waiting for an opportunity to talk about breast cancer genomics a little bit. So let's start with what you probably already know, thanks to Angelina, that there is a test that you can do for breast cancer 1 and 2 DNA. And this breast cancer genetic information, this gene, is a repair gene. And effectively what happens here is that the cancer risk is higher in people who have bad genetic repair. Now that makes sense. And you'll see very scary things quoted, something like 80 to 85% lifetime risk if you have the BRCA 1 and 2 gene, one or the BRCA 2 gene. And this does run in families. And when you see familial breast cancer, this is how it was discovered, going back and running the genetics on those people who had the breast cancer and finding out what genes they had in common, eventually it was narrowed down to these BRCA 1 and 2 genes, which were already known to be DNA repair genes, so it was plausible that that would be what was going on. Now, that 85% figure, however, is a little bit tricky. So let me just put it this way. If you have your genes done and you turn out to be BRCA positive, so let's say you have BRCA1 positivity on a 23andMe gene test, but you don't have first-degree relatives, mothers, sisters, grandmothers, daughters with breast cancer, then at a population level, your risk for breast cancer without a family history is more like 45%, because it's more than one gene involved here, and that's really what the first take-home lesson here is that if you have the family history and this gene, you've got other genes as well that are contributing a certain percentage. And the big holy grail is, what are those genes? What are the patterns? And what are the things that we want to watch for in terms of genetics that increase the risk of breast cancer? So I've got a short list here of genes that need to be checked and need to be looked at and see whether or not you have these. There's also some breast cancer models, and I want to talk about one product in particular, which is a commercially available product and relatively well-priced, so I think it's reasonable to just let you know that it exists. But first, the short list. Genes 1A1, 1B1, 3A4, COMT, GSTP1, GSTM1, and manganese SOD or MNSOD. These are all detoxification genes. And I'll circle back around to detoxification, but that seems to be one of the topics of this program. So the idea here is that if you don't break down those toxins and get them out of your body efficiently, then they can hang around and create oxidative stress, which damages DNA directly. So you want to be able to process your estrogen, and get that out of your body, because as you break down estrogen in the liver, you actually convert it sometimes into a potentially genetically mutagenic compound called 4-hydroxyestrone. You don't want that in your body for very long. You want to get rid of it. And changing estrogen metabolism through diet and nutritional modification is actually a proven strategy. So we want to talk about that a little bit in this program as well. Before I go any further, the test that I alluded to is based on some of the latest genome-wide association studies. And this is where they actually look at the entire genome of a large cohort of people, and they do machine supercomputer type analysis of it to find associations. And some of these associations across the population are very small. Maybe it increases your risk from 1.0 to 1.3. So not a huge increase, a 30% increase in risk. But if you could find the actual combination of genes, you could do risk prediction. And this company, Brevigen, looks at 77 genes, and they combine it with an also proven risk model called the Gale model that looks at things that we know also affect breast cancer risk, such as age at first term delivery, did you breastfeed, do you smoke, what's your alcohol consumption, and family history. All of that gets folded into the Gale model. And you can actually go to cancer.gov, and the link there is BC Risk Tool. So cancer.gov/BC Risk Tool. And that will get you, you can run the Gale model on yourself. This combination gives you the DNA and the Gale model and has good predictive value. So if you've got a high family risk, a family history of breast cancer, it probably makes sense to get this genetic testing and see what's going on there. If you do have high risk, there's a lot of stuff you can do. Let's talk about some of them. 1 tablespoon of ground raw flaxseed a day, 1 to 3 grams of EPA and DHA, 3 to 5 servings of soy. Yes, that's right. Proves 3 to 5 servings of soy per week, good. Unless you're on tamoxifen. You don't want to use any soy if you're on tamoxifen because it interferes with the tamoxifen. Indole-3-carbinol, 150 milligrams twice a day. Diindolemethionine, DIM that is, 100 milligrams twice a day. Maybe some rosemary, 75 milligrams. Turmeric, 250 milligrams. And lots of exercise, ladies. Exercise reduces your breast cancer risk. A low saturated fat diet probably helps as well. And getting down to ideal body weight. If you have a breast cancer genetic predisposition, getting your weight down can save your life. Let's go to our first caller. And that is Marguerite in Santa Cruz. Hello, Marguerite. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Dr. Don. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have had a sudden onset of joint pain within the past six weeks to about 2-3 months. And I've been very athletic all my life, and I kind of chalk it up to maybe athletic injuries.
How old are you and what joints?
56, both knees, both wrists, my neck, my elbow, my shoulder. I finally got in to see a doctor who ordered a blood test, which showed a quite elevated rheumatoid factor level. And I have an appointment with a rheumatologist, but I haven't been able to get in to see them soon. I'm seeing them next week. However, it's been a couple of weeks since I had the blood test. And my question is, how do I deal with the pain?
Okay. Well, the first thing is that along with seeing the rheumatologist, I would strongly encourage you to see someone who can help you look at your gut flora. This trigger could be, there is strong evidence, and I think it's I think it's Serratia species, but I'm not entirely sure what the bacteria is. I'd have to look it up. But there's a strong association between a gut flora and flares of rheumatoid arthritis, particularly a sudden onset like what you're experiencing. So it would be important to do those two tracks in parallel, because you may be able to modulate your immune system through the gut more effectively than any other way. What the rheumatologist will do is modulate your immune system using either prednisone or methotrexate, or going to one of these anti-monoclonals that attack tumor necrosis factor, which these are all legitimate therapies, and they are fundamental to the modern management of rheumatoid arthritis, and I'm not dissing them, but they don't get to the source of the cause. And mm-hmm. what you have with an elevated rheumatoid factor is you have antibodies attacking your own self, so you've got a confused immune system, and we want to calm it down. There, immune system, calm down. But we also want to try to figure out the source of the confusion and eliminate it if we can. So very important to go to the gut early and look for dysbiosis and fix it if you find it. So that could mean using either natural antibacterials or actual Xifaxamin or one of the other antibacterials. I might go with the pharmaceutical in your case, just because, you know, we really want to move on this. Now for your pain, high doses of fish oil, and I'm talking like 4 grams a day. So that's a big dose of fish oil. 500 milligrams of curcumin.
What was the 500 milligrams of what?
Curcumin. That's a derivative of turmeric. There's a drug called Xiflamend. You can buy that at any pharmacy. It's over the counter. That contains rosemary and curcumin, and it's a reasonably good, well-absorbed commercial product. You can also find lots of good forms of curcumin that are highly absorbable in the health food store. This is one where I would go with one of the products that actually has guaranteed absorption, and the clerk can help you at a lot of these stores. The clerks are actually very well educated about the products that they're selling, because they have seminars and things from the reps, and in general those are high-end products that really work. If you're on a budget, you can take turmeric that you buy at the spice counter and mix it with black pepper, 10% by weight, and just shove it into capsules and take 5 to 10 of those capsules a day. And those are natural anti-inflammatories. There's also one called cat's claw, uña de gato. It's a Mexican herbal lore product, or Central American probably, rather than specifically Mexican. That's a good anti-inflammatory, and it's also calming to the gut. So these are ways of modulating an immune system that's on a rampage. Vitamin D, you want to get your vitamin D level up to at least 70. Anyone with an autoimmune disease, that low-dose naltrexone that I mentioned earlier, that is also something that might be going after the source, the root of your problem. You know, I don't know what your situation is in terms of your health, access to healthcare, or your ability to pay for alternative medicine, but early stage rheumatoid arthritis at the perimenopause, or I presume you're menopausal within the last 5 years.
Within the past year.
Yes, so you see, that's a huge hormone shift, and that's one of the situations. Big rock gets dropped in the pond. It creates perturbations. Some of these perturbations turn into little vortices, and in this case, trigger an immune system reaction that was sitting there. You know, you had the genetic predisposition, but the environmental factors that triggered it off hadn't happened to you yet. Well, now they have, and what we want to do is try to go back and reset you to where you were before this got rolling.
Mm-hmm. What is a type of doctor that can look at the gut flora?
This would be a functional medicine physician or a naturopathic physician. Where are you located again?
Santa Cruz.
Okay, so you could come and see me. There are other doctors in town, Trinidade, Larche. I'm sorry if I'm forgetting somebody, but the point is, this is medical care that you can access. Go to functionalmedicine.org and put in your zip code, and you'll get a list of functional medicine physicians who are registered, and that's a good place to start. Or you could call my office and on Monday and talk with my office manager about setting up an appointment. That would be okay with me. But you don't have to come and see me. There are other qualified physicians in town.
Okay, Dr. Dawn, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, and please do act on this.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And let's go now to Larry in Atlanta. Hello, Larry. Long time no hear.
Good, Dr. Dawn. Thank you so much. Dr. Dawn, as always, you're so sweet. Thank you so much. Well, I'll just get to the point. Recently, I had an STD examination. I discovered that I have herpes antigens. I think I might have gotten that from my current girlfriend. I'm not sure. I can't tell you right now if it's herpes 1 or 2. I can't recall. But a few questions. One, are there any long-term consequences or side effects to having this condition? Two, can I transmit it if I have, you know, vaginal sex or oral sex, you know, with another lady? And are there any, you know, remedies or cures for it?
All right, so let's start with question number one. First of all, I think it was antibodies that they doctor tested, not antigens.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Let me just continue. So we'll take it as read that it was antibodies that testing, because that would be routinely done. And
yes.
The HSV-1 is 99% of the time, that's an oral herpes that you got from Aunt Betty when you were six and she gave you a big gooey kiss. So that's cold sores. That's oral ulceration around the lips, maybe on the chin or the nose. And this type of herpes, of course, is transmitted by kissing. The HSV-1 virus does not do well in the genitals. It does not thrive there. So very rarely will you find people with this kind of genital herpes. The HSV-2, that's the genital one, doesn't do well in the mouth. And so generally you will not get cold sores that have on the oral mucosa that have the HSV-2. So they differentiate fairly well. There's a little bit of crossover, particularly in people who are immunosuppressed, but for the normal healthy individual, one is the mouth and the other is the genitals. In terms of long-term health implications, the mouth one is probably worse if you have the Alzheimer's gene. So there are some genes that are associated with Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is more common in people who have the EPOA4 genetics. Many people have had their genetics done now, and they will know whether they have that or not. That gene is implicated also sometimes in cardiovascular risk and was initially studied because it conveys more heart disease risk, but it also conveys Alzheimer's risk. And it seems to code for the proteins that accumulate in the brain. And so what we're thinking is that maybe you have a slightly different shape of the protein based on this gene, and therefore it's more likely to accumulate in the brain. Bottom line is, there's an association between Alzheimer's and oral herpes in people who have the APOE4 genome. So what we tell those people is regular lysine and to always treat their oral lesions with anti-herpes drugs like valacyclovir if they start to get an outbreak. And we do that because we think they will, in the long term, benefit with respect to the Alzheimer's. Now, your transmission, as far as herpes 2 goes, there isn't a strong association with cancer. There is some association with AIDS, but that typically is just because if you have a herpes lesion and you have sex, the AIDS is going to be able to get through that ulcer much more easily. It's probably just a mechanical association. Transmission is, you have to look at the history. If you have never had an outbreak if it's HSV-2 and you have never had an outbreak, then your risk of transferring it is close to, but not zero.
Okay.
All right. Now, if you've had an outbreak of genital ulceration and you have HSV-2, then the risk is not zero, and you might consider using preventative daily valacyclovir, which is now generic. And this, at this point, what I recommend to people who want to do their diligence and not transmit this is, you know, safe sex practice, which would be condoms, and daily use, if you're trying to get pregnant, then for the male, at least daily use of valacyclovir to prevent the herpes virus from being able to erupt and infect the mate. And nothing's 100%, but those are pretty good protections. And the data is fairly clear that even though you don't have an outbreak, you can still transmit herpes. But it's much more common if you get outbreaks that you transmit between outbreaks. People who never get outbreaks have a much, much, much lower risk of transmitting to others.
Okay. Dr. Ott, a few follow-up questions. One, did you say, or did I understand you say that someone who has, and again, I don't know which one it is, but someone who has the HNC2 has a higher risk of getting Alzheimer's?
It's the HSV1.
We
think of as harmless, but it does have its dark side.
Okay, and then now the valacyclovir, if I'm saying it right, is that an antiviral medication?
Yes.
Or what is that?
Yeah, it's an antiviral pharmaceutical, now available as a generic. What it does is it's a chain terminator. So the way you build DNA, you link one thing onto another. So the nucleotides get hooked together, and they have to have a back hook so that the next one can hook onto it. Think like a train, right? You got a hook in the front and a hook in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you imagine putting a train car in there that doesn't have a back hook, that's what valacyclovir is. So it gets in there, it hooks onto the growing DNA chain, but then the next nucleotide can't hook onto it because there's nothing for it to hook onto. So that bit of DNA is wasted, and this, if you get a high enough level inside the cells, the virus can't reproduce because its DNA keeps getting terminated.
Well, I guess someone said to me as we have suppressing it, because there's no cure for it, I understand, as we have suppressing it, I should take antiviral medication, maybe like the valacyclovir, every day.
Right. Yeah, and that is the advice that I would probably give if you came and said, look, I've got HSV2, I don't want to infect my partner, what's my move? Well, that's your move.
Okay. Tom, as always, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Larry. Keep listening out there in Atlanta.
I love you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Stephen in Santa Cruz. Hi, what can I do for you?
I believe that I have what I think is a Baker's cyst on my left, behind my left knee.
Okay, probably is.
It developed about 3-4 days ago, and it's doing a little bit of a pain down my calf. And a little bit of research that I've looked into, it says it can possibly be an aneurysm or a tumor, but it doesn't feel tumorish. It's been painful. It's very painful when I stretch the leg out and tighten the leg.
Yeah. The thing that it also could be is a blood clot. And if you have a blood clot in a vein, it can mimic a Baker's cyst. And so this is easily settled with an ultrasound, just a simple peripheral ultrasound. That's probably a radiology visit. The thing is, if you've been immobilized for a while, if it's a Baker's cyst, it's probably because you've been super active. If you haven't been active and you've been immobile, a long car trip, long plane trip,
I had a plane flight yesterday, actually, and I'm
before,
pretty active.
But before or after this thing showed up?
After.
All right. So, basically, immobilization makes me worry about blood clot. Lots of activity makes it much more likely that it's a Baker's cyst, which is essentially a ganglion cyst, but it's a big ganglion cyst. And when they leak, they can irritate the calf. You do need to get it checked out. Do you have a regular primary care doctor that could...
My primary care physician moved, actually, last year to Tahoe, but I'm local here and I can go to... I do have a primary here on the west side.
Okay, so you might contact their office and see if they can just order you up an ultrasound. I would do it soon, at least, okay. or go in there and drop if they have an urgent doctor doing urgent care. It's Saturday, so they likely do, and get it checked. If it's suspicious for a vein, then it needs an ultrasound. But a good okay. a good doctor can figure can you know kind of settle this one fairly well.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Don't mess around though. Do follow up on it.
I will. Thank you.
Bye bye. Going now to Bruce in Aptos. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, welcome.
Thank you. Myriad of different physical ailments, but the one I want to talk about is central spinal stenosis. I had surgery about 4 years ago, and the reason I did that is I had atrophy in my calf.
Mm.
On one side.
Yep, that's a good reason.
I was hoping that the calf would come back. It hasn't. I do have some sensation in the calf, but the muscle mass hasn't come back.
Mm.
Is there any things I can ingest that would help with that, or any therapies that help with that muscle coming back?
Well, have you had a nerve conduction study to see what the status of the nerve is since your surgery?
I thought about going back to the doctor who did the nerve conduction study.
Yeah, well, you know, I would, and here's why. If you've got reasonable tonic stimulation, which is, think of a clock ticking. All of our nerves tick away, and they send a little signal, blip, blip, blip to our muscle, and that if that signal's intact, then aggressive physical therapy will work, and you can build your calf muscle back up. And what it's going to take is lots and lots of stimulation to trigger the DNA in the muscles to start building muscle again. Because essentially, that tonic stimulation is an absolute requirement to rebuild the muscle mass. And if that's gone, then you can strengthen the muscle somewhat, but you won't be able to get it rehabilitated much.
Okay,
so that is an important differentiator. If the tonic stimulation is, it even if it's weak, if it's still there, and it, since you have sensation, there's a good chance that it is. This is a mixed nerve, however, so we don't know for sure how much of the motor function is still there. But assuming that you've got enough stimulation, things that support the membranes might be beneficial. So that means, omega-3 fatty acids and two other things, phosphatidylserine, phosphatidylcholine. These compounds are part of the membrane components of nerves and are helpful when you're trying to get a nerve to work better. Other things to look at is make sure that you've got enough vitamins, and this is particularly true of B12, which is really important for nerve regrowth. And so, you know, if your B12 level isn't at least 500, I'd probably start taking supplements.
Okay.
Yeah,
all
there's
right.
No magic pill on this one, but a lot of hard work, I'm afraid. How's your pain? Are you out of pain?
It's gone, yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. Okay.
And the numbness in my foot that also accompanied it is gone.
Good.
So the surgery is extremely successful.
Yeah. The other thing there is, the other thing that just crossed my mind is there's a rehab technique where they do passive electrical stimulation of the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And that might, I saw a commercial device that was available. It was kind of like a TENS unit, but it was like pads that you put on the skin and it would make the muscle twitch. Something like that could actually be very helpful. I mean, it's probably uncomfortable, but if you could tolerate it, that might also help build back up the muscle mass.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, looks like we've got time for one last quick question. Let's go to Anna in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anna. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thank
Hi.
You so much. The question is 2-25-hydroxy vitamin D tests that were different tests with different results 9 months apart. Each doctor is saying the other test is the wrong test. One test, so the first test I had that my results were 56, was a vitamin D 125 and then parentheses OH.
Yes. So 1,25, right?
Yes. 1,25 and then parentheses the,
right.
OH.
Got it. I know. And the other test, let me guess, was 25 OH vitamin D without the one. I heard the first one. What was the second one? Sorry to interrupt.
They're both one. Vitamin D, one was the Quest Lab, vitamin D 1,25, mm-hmm. and that had, the total had one, and then the D1, D3, D2, and then the total. The other one, where I got 9 months later and was 23 instead,
You mean, okay, you mean 23 hydroxy?
No, 23 was my result,
uh-huh.
and it was total OHD. It was OHD, and it was, my total was 23. 9 months later, and I take 3,000 to 4,000 a day. It's never changed.
So it's difficult to do this over the phone, obviously, because I can't see the results, but let me just say that the correct test to get under most circumstances is a 25 hydroxy vitamin D. And when that comes back, it'll give you the vitamin D2 and the vitamin D3. I have never seen a vitamin D1. That's 25 hydroxy, not 1,25 hydroxy. And the 25 hydroxy is the one we use for storage. The 125 is the activated vitamin D, and that varies a lot and is much harder to interpret. For example, under inflammatory conditions, that will tend to drop, and so it's not a reliable indicator of vitamin D sufficiency or capacity. So it's the 25 hydroxy vitamin D, and it's very plausible that the second test, that you have 25 hydroxy at 23 and that you have 1,25 hydroxy at 56. So there may not be a conflict between these two tests. It may be part of how it's annotated. I suspect that different labs looking at it differently, and I would tend to see that the doctors could be saying that, yes, this is the wrong test, disagreeing because of nuances related to your case, which we can't address here on the air. So if you want to send me those two copies or pictures of them in the mail, if you send them via email, you are violating your own privacy, so I'm not allowed to solicit that, but I will try to answer your question. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.